The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, we may not remember our earliest days, but that doesn't mean infants aren't making memories. And in a challenging time for higher education, we'll speak with the college presidents of two merging institutions. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Adults can't remember their infancies, a time when brains are growing and learning at an extraordinary pace. It's long been thought that very young children cannot remember their earliest days because their brains are still developing, but a study by our next guest challenges the idea of infantile amnesia. I spoke with Tristan Yates, a former Yale University graduate student, now a postdoctoral researcher at Columbia University, to learn more.
This is a team project, so there's a lot of people involved. I think we all had different ideas and interests. So I can speak to mine personally, which is memories kind of what makes us human. I actually wrote an essay in undergrad about episodic and autobiographical memory being what makes us human. And so I've had an intrinsic interest in memory for a very long time. And infancy is a really interesting period because obviously it's very foundational for the rest of our lives. We all started out as babies. We learned so much during that time. And yet it's a gap in our memory for almost every human being on Earth. And so I was really interested in graduate school to try and tackle some of the reasons why that might be the case.
So what part of the brain, maybe we can start there, what part of the brain actually holds on to memories? Is there one specific area that's most important?
Yeah, so memories, many different things. So I'll just establish that we're talking here about episodic memory. So that's the term that we use for memory of what happened at a particular space and time. So like what happened on your last birthday. So episodic memory is mostly associated with this brain region called the hippocampus. And we know this from some really awesome work that happened in the several decades ago, where this person named Patient HM, we now know his full name was Henry Molaison. When he passed away, they released his name. He had seizures and so had some surgery to remove the hippocampus. That was kind of where the seizures were happening. And what happened was he was not able to form new memories, new episodic memories. Yet he could do like different things. Like he could write fine, like a bunch of like what we would call procedural memories were intact, but he had this episodic memory that was really impacted by the removal of the hippocampus. And so that's really the brain region that we think is involved in this type of memory.
So then long-term memories, if you will, I can remember serial jingles and TV commercials from when I was a kid, but sometimes might have, you know, trouble remembering what I ate for breakfast this morning. So talking about two different parts of the brain here then, right?
Yeah. So the hippocampus is especially important for rapidly encoding new memories. Encoding is kind of a fancy term, but forming new memories. And so over time, the hippocampus is thought to teach the rest of the brain those memories. And so as it teaches the rest of the brain, some of those details become lost. So you might not remember the specific instances in which you heard those jingles, but those become kind of more what's called semantic memories, and memories for facts, general facts that have been abstracted away from the specific experiences.
So your research into infants then, when you're talking about the brain and the hippocampus in particular, you know, where did you want to explore and what were the methods involved into actually studying very young children here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the hippocampus is a kind of seahorse shaped structure. It's pretty small. It's located really deep inside the brain. Because it's located deep inside the brain, we have to use certain technologies to be able to access what's going on there. So when we study babies and we study baby memory, a lot of people use neuroimaging techniques that are based on the scalp. So if you've ever seen those cute pictures of babies wearing like head caps that have little electrodes on them, that's an EEG net, and we can get activity from the brain through that EEG net, but it's really specific to the parts of the brain that are more peripheral. So it's not able to access the deep brain regions. So we needed to use functional magnetic resonance imaging, so fMRI, to be able to get at what was happening in the hippocampus. That's the best method for looking at the brain in a non-invasive way.
So, tell me about babies' brains. What happens in a baby's head in their early years?
A lot, a ton happens in their early years. So we're starting to learn a lot more about this as fMRI and structural MRI is being more widely used. But we know that for the most part, everything's like kind of in place. You have a brain that's shaped like it will be shaped in adulthood, but it grows massively, like several fold over the first few years of life. Other structural changes happen in the brain over the first few years of life. So that's another reason why it's really interesting and important to look at the infancy period because there's a lot that's changing and a lot of development.
So tell me about then the research method that was applied here. And going back to the hippocampus, how did you actually, you and your team, conduct the experiments to see what babies can actually remember?
Yeah, so this task is a really simple task inspired by decades of work that have looked at baby cognition. And so we wanted to look at one piece of episodic memory, which is that it's formed rapidly with a single exposure. And so in this task, we were interested in how memories are formed for single events. So the events in our study were just pictures. We would show babies pictures of faces, objects, or landscape scenes. And we would show them a bunch of pictures in a row. And a minute after they saw one picture, let's say it was a picture of a canyon, a landscape of a canyon, 1 minute after we showed them that, we would show them that same image alongside a new landscape, like a waterfall. And we wanted to see if the babies would look differently at those two images, one that they had seen before and one that they had not seen before. And so we expected that the babies would look more at the image that they had seen before. And when they did that, we could look back what's happening in their brain the first time they saw it. So that's a key part of the task is we're interested in how the memories were formed that they later express through their eye movements. And that's where we saw greater hippocampal activity when they were seeing an image for the first time.
Sure, and it does sort of make sense because I would think that babies can recognize their own parents, and they do have the ability to build familiarity around themselves even when they're very, very young. But I guess the question at the core of this research going back is why don't we remember it later on? So
Yeah.
how did you go about digging into that specific part of it?
Yeah, it's great. So memory is multiple things. Memory consists of forming the memory for the first time, and then you have to store it somewhere over time, and then later you have to recall it. In this experiment, we wanted to test the memory formation hypothesis for why we don't remember things later on. Is it the case that we're not able to form these kind of single event memories in infancy? Like you said, like babies learn a lot. They learn their parents' face, and so we have many reasons to expect that they're able to form these memories. It might be the case that they're only able to form them over multiple exposures. So, like you see your parents' face every day, multiple times a day. That's why we designed the task to be able to look at memory for single events.
Is there evidence that suggests that children, when they do become a little older and they get to the age where, you know, as adults, you can look back and say, well, I remember going into kindergarten and I remember going into, you know, maybe nursery school or other kinds of earlier memories. Is there evidence that when children do become of that certain age, that they do retain some memories, but maybe they're not actively aware of it? They do have a sense of familiarity when they see something or they see a pattern or a photo, and they may not even realize that they are remembering something. Is that also maybe a part of this?
Yeah. And so that's why we're really excited about using neuroimaging, because, you know, you can't ask a baby what they remember all the time. And so we can kind of use their brains as a way of assessing if the memory is still there in some form. So we have some preliminary work that kind of shows exactly what you're suggesting, that around the preschool, early elementary school age, even if kids can't fully express their memories from infancy, their brains will express those memories. So they'll show hippocampal activity when viewing videos of their own memories from infancy versus viewing someone else's memories from infancy, things that they didn't experience. And in this case study experiment, we actually see that that fades away by later childhood. So it's really preliminary work, but it also fits a lot of things that, you know, I've had in conversations with my friends who have kids in these age ranges, that like their 4 and 5 year olds will remember things that happened several years ago. But then, you know, over time, those memories get lost.
Now, how about the question of, is there an ability to unlock these memories as adults? Do you think that it might be possible to find the part of the brain or the part of the hippocampus that holds on to these episodic memories, and through technology and maybe there's, you know, some ethical questions about this, but to actually bring those old memories back in, something like unlocking these memories?
Yeah. It's a really interesting idea, and one that's pretty sci-fi. But, you know, so our particular study doesn't tell us where the memories go after they're first formed. It's still very possible that some of the memories are just forgotten, but other memories might actually stay in the brain for longer periods of time. And here's where research in non-human animals is really suggestive. So there's some series of like really beautiful studies that have used rodent models that have learned something in infancy, and then they can test the memory in a rodent as an adult. And those studies show that memories from infancy can persist into adulthood and be actually recalled through stimulating the neurons, the brain cells that were active during the initial experience. So they've shown this in a few different ways, using things like associating a particular room with an aversive shock, or with rodents running through a maze. So normally, a baby rodent running through a maze, you'd forget that memory in adulthood, but if you can stimulate the brain to the neurons that were active in infancy, then you can get them to finish the maze as adults. That's pretty cool. That's like, that's saying that those infant memories can be unlocked later on. We don't know if that is the case for humans. That's going to be really difficult because we don't typically stimulate the neurons in humans, although there is some really cool work that does that in patients who have epilepsy and have devices inside their brains. I think, you know, maybe it's possible. What that would look like, what that experience would be, to be determined. That's probably going to be something that's not the same as remembering something from a few years ago.
Why do you think that this topic of exploring memory and forming memories as babies and being able to lift the curtain on a time period that a lot of people feel like they miss out on, maybe. Why do you think that this is so fascinating? I feel like we might have all seen a movie or read a book or heard a story, a fictional story about the one character that can see all the way back, you know, to the moment that they were born. And it seems like it's something that's prevailed for as long as, you know, I've been consuming popular culture. But why do you think that this is such a prevailing idea and so interesting to people?
Yeah, I mean, it's been so interesting to people forever, right? It's, as I mentioned at the beginning, memory is kind of who we are. We tell stories about ourselves. And so memory from our earliest moments could inform, you know, the story that we tell of our lives. It's also this term for the lack of memories from infancy is infantile amnesia. And it's a term that was actually coined by Sigmund Freud. And so when he talked about infantile amnesia, he talked about the active repression of our infant memories. You know, I don't think people actually believe that aspect anymore, but it has, you know, real implications for our earliest experiences and how they impact us through the rest of our lives.
And Tristan, where will your research take you next? What else are you looking forward to exploring?
Yeah, so we have the study that I just described about early childhood memories that seem to fade by later childhood. People at Yale are continuing that line of research by tracking memories longitudinally in children. I think that's a really fascinating and exciting direction that the lab at Yale is pursuing, because then we're going to actually be able to, you know, figure out when these memories from infancy become inaccessible. For me, I'm still interested in this memory formation question. So, you know, some memories are more powerful than others. A lot of people have been reaching out with their own earliest memories, which has been really awesome to read. And, you know, many of them have similar flavors. People remember, you know, something negative that happened early on, or they remember certain social interactions. And so in my work now, I'm tapping into that last thing about social interactions. The most important people in our lives as babies are our caregivers. And so how do the caregivers in your environment shape what you're able to remember and how long you're able to remember that?
Tristan, thank you so much for taking the time again. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much.
Tristan Yates' research into infant memories is published in the journal Science. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. A private upstate New York liberal arts college and an independent pharmacy school are ready to join forces. Russell Sage College, with campuses in Albany and Troy, New York, and the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences are seeking to combine by fall 2027. The recent announcement comes in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic and amid changing attitudes about higher education. To learn more about the planned merger, I spoke with Russell Sage College President Matthew Schaftel and ACPHS President Toyin Tafade.
So the pharmacy enrollment histories around the country has now started turning to the right direction. And we are actually quite excited to report that for both institutions, actually, we did have an uptick in our enrollments this past year. And that makes me really, really excited about the synergies, but also the willingness to work together to continue to provide comprehensive education for our students and a broader, you know, swath of opportunities for our students. So the opportunities are really endless in this case. And just as President Schaftel indicated, we have a way for dual degrees, 2+3. We have 1+2+1 for the nursing. They have a really strong traditional nursing program. I mean, we have collaborators around the New Scotland Avenue, Albany Med. We have St. Peter's Health Partners. I mean, we have Albany Law. It's really the timing is perfect, in my opinion. I can't speak to what was said before I arrived, obviously, because I wasn't there, but I can tell you that the boards of both institutions have chosen to go forward with this because they see that it's the right thing to do for a time like this.
This would have been the right decision to make 20 years ago. To be fair, the work that we're doing has such synergy and such opportunity for students going forward. This is a merger that just makes sense from a student perspective and from a community perspective. The way we can serve the community is really ideal. But as President Tafati was mentioning, between the two institutions, we added 800 students last year. That is huge. And because we have positioned ourselves between the two institutions, we've added about 21 new programs over the last couple of years. So we're making investments. We're seeing the fruit of those investments right now. But this is a time where institutions that are more comprehensive, that offer the adult learner, the continuing learner, the brand new first time in college student, a range of opportunities. And those opportunities are going to change over time, as we know that students are changing and they're going to change careers 4 or 5 times over their lifetime. So to be able to be in a position where not only can our current students say, come in as an 18-year-old and say at 20, you know, actually, what I really wanted to do was this. I really want to study biopharmaceuticals. That opportunity exists, but also our alums can come back at the age of 36, 45, or my grandmother started her PhD at 60. They can really choose to come back to this combined institution and retool and reengage in the workforce. And so I think the timing is right, but also the meaning and the synergy was right 20 years ago. I'm just glad that we're finally doing what makes sense.
Absolutely.
So it's a lot of added flexibility.
And lots of expanded opportunities. And President Chaftel was talking about the community impact, because this is important for the listeners to also be aware of. We have the number one social mobility is what Russell Sage's ranking is, according to the U.S. News and World Reports, and that's in the Northeast. This is a very important ranking, as you can imagine. And Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences actually has a collaboratory that exists in the south end of Albany. In fact, we had conversations with the Chamber of Commerce leader in Troy to say, you know, we could consider a situation where we have some of those services in Troy. And what is the collaboratory? It has co-located in the south end of Albany on Pearl Street, working together with Trinity Health Alliance to have social workers, health educators, pharmacist technicians, public health specialists to be able to serve the needs of the underserved in that region. Now, can you imagine having additional expertise with the OT, PT, nutrition students and experts that are at Russell Sage to be able to join with the students and experts that already exist at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences in serving a community like that? You expand the opportunities for service learning. We are already collaborating. Both institutions are already collaborating with Albany Law. They have agreed through their Justice Center to be able to send some of their students also to that same location. This is what community is about, and we believe that this combination, this merger, will really produce, you know, become the leader of health professions education in the region. The economic impact is really quite significant, because the net assets that we have together is $256 million. So we are committed to the residents of the region, we are committed to the capital region, and we believe that we can do even better together.
Now, will the merger have any effect on the cost of attending college, or will it provide any more opportunities when you're speaking about social mobility? Will it create new opportunities for reducing the cost of higher education?
So, Lucas, this is a great question. And of course, both institutions have a strong commitment to college attainment. How do we make college more accessible for students? How do we serve all of the populations and help those who might dream about going to college to get to college and to be able to afford it, but also those who think they don't deserve to dream about going to college? Mm-hmm. So I think that that cornerstone of our missions and how we serve our community is really there. So a commonly misunderstood fact is the cost of a college education has actually been dropping for the last several years. So since COVID, there's national studies that show that the actual costs students pay is roughly 4% lower on average for a private institution than it was pre-COVID. So we are doing everything we can to manage those costs, to control those costs. And once you take federal aid and state aid, we are able to offer college at an incredibly attractive price point for our students, and especially students in need. Our number one ranking as the number one private school in the entire Northeast, in fact, the number two if you go anywhere east of the Mississippi, is because we are able to provide the right amount of support, financial support for our students. We're able to help students to understand that college is actually an option for them. We are able to make sure that they have the significant skills that they need and to give them a transformational education, graduate them, and place them in jobs. So we have a 96% placement rating 6 months from graduation. And because we have that ranking, we can say assuredly that we are front and center thinking about how do we make sure that college is more attainable for students in our region.
The other thing I'm really excited about, in addition to what he has said, is that both institutions have faculty that care about the students.
Deeply.
And so we expect that the student experience will remain the same or be enhanced. That was something that was really central to this negotiation, is the student experience must not be affected negatively. And so I'm really excited about the expanded opportunities that we have for all the students, whether they're at Russell Sage College or whether they're at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences.
Well, President Tafadeh and President Sheftel, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you for your time today.
If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1803. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.